Hello and welcome back to Illumination, the Disney Lorcana podcast. My name is Max.
And I'm Sam.
And this episode, we're looking at Shimmering Skies. We got eyes in the skies for this episode. And we want to talk about how we decide and make an evaluation if a card is going to be playable or how competitive a card might be. So I wanted to get a quick disclaimer in there before I start going through our process. Also, an announcement before the disclaimer. Announcement: we will be doing our usual set review coming up on this coming Sunday. If you're hearing this at the time of release, that would be August 4th of 2024. We will be doing that at 8 o'clock Eastern over on our Twitch channel. If you want to watch it, is twitch.tv/supraliminalfilms, all one word, supraliminal films. If you can spell it, you can find it. And of course, we'll be in the Disney channel. If you go to Twitch and look under Disney, we'll be there as well doing that review. As always, we will release a recap here for you beloved viewers who listen to our long set reviews. And we wanted to give you some background information. We haven't done this yet. And since we're going to be evaluating another big load of cards, it would be a good time to probably give you some insight onto how we evaluate cards, how the testing group we work with evaluate cards, and I think in general, how a lot of people tend to come to a decision on cards, especially sight unseen, right? Like, these are generally untested or the first cards you want to target to start testing. Now we're going to play with our paper proxies and our testing versions of cards to try to see if these cards are in fact as good as we think they are, or where does this very good card have a home, if at all. So now that I'm done that announcement, disclaimer: not every powerful card is going to be a playable card. We're discussing playability in core constructed for Lorcana. That is the sole evaluation we are making. We're not talking about limited. We're not talking about multiplayer. We might mention them, as that might be a possible home for a card every now and again, because everybody gets to play this game the way they wish, which is very important. But our evaluations and the way we look at cards is specifically through the lens of core constructed. Now, that being said, not every card that looks underpowered is going to be unplayable either. There may be cards that look a little like, what is this card doing here? But it serves an important part of a deck. We see this from time to time with cards that now, in this day and age of almost five sets in at time of recording, and we still see people playing cards that are stats. We saw this with the red yellow location deck that Towelman Purple made popular, playing card soldiers. We saw this especially towards the very end at the Challenger event with Purple Steel making a big breakout event, and that was on the back of Big Boy Chen Po.
Argus, 4-1, that's shutting off Flynn Rider, got pretty popular at the end of
this right meta. At the end of set championships meta. Yeah, 4-1 for 2 Inkable Titan just shut down a lot of Flynn Rider shenanigans out of the gate and trades up pretty effectively with that 4 strength. So yes, great call out there as well. So we're going to try our best to determine what is good, what's different, what is going to be playable. And I just don't want anybody to be like, well, this card's crazy powerful. And you may be right, but there may be reasons why it does not get core constructed play. And goodness knows, we'll probably miss some, because none of us would have put Argus on the very playable side, except for maybe Steadfast, who was playing it with weight set like right out of the gate. So shout out to Steadfast for being so far ahead of the curve that he was at the end of the meta at the beginning. Well done. So let's first talk about one of the things we look at. And I think it's one of the easiest ways to evaluate the cards, or most obvious, I should say. And that is when a card comes out that fulfills a need in a pre-existing archetype. And when I say archetype, I mean a strategy. So for example, a couple versions of an archetype might be the blue item-based strategy. So we see this a lot with Blue Steel. We see this a lot with Ruby Sapphire. These are the decks where their strategy is to ramp up in ink very quickly, generate a whole bunch of ink, and start playing very powerful, expensive cards way ahead of schedule. Another archetype, Sam?
Aggro.
So you're talking about cheap and aggressively statted characters, perhaps?
Yes.
Things that give us the ability to come back from behind. Cards like Arthur is a good example of something that helped the aggro decks along, especially the quote-unquote hyper-aggro style decks.
Yes, or like Piglet was a good one for the aggro decks.
A great one, yes. Poop Pirate Captain, one of my all-time favorites. There are also tempo-style decks. We see this a lot with the very popular green-purple, and a little bit more controlling with the Ruby Amethyst-style deck. So there are a bunch of different strategies. What does this card fill a need in one of those. So for example, blue decks in Chapter 1 were struggling immensely. Blue wasn't a super playable color. We all saw the potential in cards like Tamatoa and One Jump Ahead. Mm-hmm. But until a little item that came out and cost 1 was printed in Rise of the Floodborne, the color struggled pretty badly. And that card was Popsicle. And it definitely filled a need that that deck had. It put a cheap item on the board. It also refilled your hand by replacing itself, which was excellent. And the card is an absolute staple of the color at this point.
Right. And I think Hyrum goes right along with that.
Absolutely does. We're going to call out that particular card several times during this. Does it fill a need? Does it improve over an existing card? I think we saw one of the biggest improvements possible when in the first chapter meta, especially in the Ruby Amethyst decks, we were playing the 3-cost uninkable Rafiki. So 3-3 for 3 uninkable with Rush, quested for 1. Then in Rise of the Floodborne, we got one of the most defining cards of the entire game of Lorcana, and that was the 3-cost inkable 4-3 Rush, Madame Mim Fox, which is an absolute contender for one of the, if not the best card printed in the game up to this point. This card is extraordinarily format and game defining, and that was an extreme upgrade over Rafiki. And finally, when you're looking at filling a need, does this card help the deck win the game? I think that we got another big up for Sapphire in Into the Inklands when we got a little item. By little, I mean gigantic. It's a little item, really, if you think about it, though. It's a dime. But it costs 7 because it's so darn lucky. And that card ended up really defining how these decks won the game now. It wasn't long and grindy, and they just exhausted everything and won with a couple cards in deck. That can still happen. But now with the redundancy of Tamatoa and the ability to play Lucky Dime and activate Lucky Dime, when your Tamatoa can casually add 6 or 7 lore to your lore total, that card became a win condition. And we saw similar with the Queen's Castle, which is now how the Ruby Amethyst decks tend to win the game if they're not just goading, which is another thing that helps that deck win the game. That deck's gotten a lot of tools, it seems like, over time, and it's definitely changed. In the first chapter meta, Ruby Amethyst was a straight-up long game control deck. You played Magic Mirrors.
You went to time.
Time, decked out. Literally, the tech was befuddling your magic brooms so that you didn't mill yourself out. That's how long and grindy these games were. Cut to now, the preferred line of play is Flynn Rider, Frenemy on 2, Sisu and Bolden Warrior on 3, Queen's Castle on 4 to try to close the game out in a couple of turns.
Right.
Explosive power like we hadn't seen previously. Quite a bit different. All the cards we just talked about fill a different need. And I think that's an important step in evaluating a card. And it's obviously easier to do, or at least more obvious to spot, because a lot of times when you're playing the deck, you're going to go, oh, if only I had a card that did this. Oh, if only this card did this. And then they print that card for you, and it's like, oh, my prayers have been answered. This is exactly what the deck needed.
Yeah, my hope is that we'll get a good Ruby or Amethyst item removal.
Yes.
I know we got some bounce this set, but
yeah, it definitely knocks them off tempo. When they play Lucky Dime too fast, that's usually how the game spirals out of control for Ruby Amethyst when they're playing against the blue decks, because then they just get value every time they play something before you can be prepared, and that makes it very hard to win. So if it's not filling a need in a current deck, then maybe it's a card that'll make a whole new archetype or fill in parts to create a strategy that was a fringe playable strategy. One of the most obvious examples of this would be, again, going from Tamatoa to Popsicle, right? We knew Tamatoa was going to be awesome. We knew this card was going to be very powerful.
Right, but in the set 1, there was nothing.
There was nothing
really
to do.
Work.
Right. So is this card opening the gate for something brand new? So is it something crazy powerful? We saw this in our most recent set at time of recording, which was Ursula's Return, a little 3-cost birdie called Diablo. This card completely warped the metagame. It made it to where one could argue it was a major contributor to Bucky being errated and changed over to the point where it might most likely not be playable anymore because Diablo is just so darn powerful. Hyrum Flaversham completely created what seemed like an unbeatable archetype for the first 4 to 6 weeks of Floodborne core constructed. It was extraordinarily powerful. It was baffling that a card that powerful could be printed, levels of baffling. I was concerned about the game's health when I saw that card.
It seems like when a new set releases, we definitely have that one deck that just beats everything for the first couple weeks.
And in Public Enemy number one, that is definitely, we talked about that in our metagames episode, so good call out there as well. For sure, there's one strategy that's just like, this is real good now, and then it takes us a few weeks to figure out how to beat it. Green Steel was the bully of the format up until very, very recently. Probably like second to third week into set champs, we started to see finally a bit of a decline there. If it's doing something new, does it allow a deck maybe to play around things that are in the meta or get an edge in these cards? So for example, Ursula, Deceiver, Bare Necessities, two cards that kept the control decks down because they were so much faster than Be Prepared. But we got a huge boost when Sisu came out, the big legendary Sisu. Wow. Now we have a way to play something on 8 that's untouchable in our hand unless it's just purely discarded, or conversely shift it on 6. So it can even come out ahead of schedule and very ahead of schedule sometimes. If you do Sisu on 3, ramp again, and then you can get the big Sisu down as early as turn 4 or 5. It's very, very oppressive. So that really helped and became such a playable card because it played around a lot of the hand disruption that was very, very popular, especially at the beginning of the Ursula's Return metagame. So that's making something new. Sam, is there any other card you want to call out in the making something new category? Just making sure I didn't overlook anything.
The only thing I can think of is maybe like locations. We did see some location control decks.
Absolutely. We did see a few of those. Again, Talman Purple coming up and making some cards like Tiana's Palace and the Underworld all of a sudden very scary. Brought back Jim Hawkins and the card that was somehow very good in that deck that I don't think is very good just in time. It was just very powerful, very quick to the ground and just created a lore advantage. Ruby Amethyst ended up kind of replicating in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that deck, if you get caught off guard with it, nothing you can really do.
Some other things to keep in mind that don't really like fill out an entire category on their own. The major contributor, I would say, above all else, is the cost. Cost is everything. The sooner you can do something, the more powerful it is. We saw this with Diablo. The big play pattern for Emerald Steel, and we talked about it a lot on the podcast, is turn one Diablo, check their hand, coast is clear. Turn two Bucky, shift Diablo, and then sing something. The Lemon Lime decks really take pretty obnoxious advantage of this because you replace Bucky with Ursula, strip out their song removal, and then sing Bare Necessities with the shifted Diablo, and then strip out like their Baboom. I've just beaten Green Steel several games where it's just like, I've taken all your removal now, so I'm going to have Diablo out for the next multiple turns. It's very, very oppressive against Ruby Amethyst. You get to strip out their Brawls, and then it's just, you guarantee it sticks around. The cost is everything in a lot of cases. A good example of this when it comes to flexibility, especially, we're talking about inkability, we're talking about options on the card. These are very important. So cost and flexibility really are the hallmarks. The new Pete game referee is really quite a bit different. He's a 3/3/1 for 3 inkable that when he comes into play until the start of your next turn, your opponent can't play actions. That is absolutely insane. And it's very similar to a card we had previously, which was Tiana, the 4-cost uninkable that required you to have no cards in hand and her to be exerted. So you can see the cost and the flexibility are so much less for Tiana than they are for Pete. Pete, if it's not going to be useful, I ink it. Tiana, stuck in my hand. If I draw 2 Tianas and I can't play them, it's going to be even harder for the first Tiana to go off. Pete doesn't have that problem. Pete can play with Madam Mim very well because you pick it up and put it back down. Tiana, not so much.
No actions turn after turn.
Right. You can see kind of the flexibility and the positives and negatives. Another example of cost being a major factor is sometimes we see an effect that's big and grandiose, but it's expensive. So we'll see this usually attached to like rares or super rares where like a very stripped down version will be on a common. So a good example of this, 2 very playable cards would be Elsa versus Pinocchio. Pinocchio's old 2-drop that's uninkable that comes in and just exerts. It doesn't freeze or keep something exerted. It just exerts. But on the other hand, we have Elsa, who's a gigantic 8-drop that's uninkable. It quests for a lot and it comes down and it exerts 2 characters and keeps them exerted. Huge difference in what you're getting. Huge difference in cost. cards that are typically on the Elsa side of the spectrum are the ones that tend to be less playable. A good call out to represent this would be a card like Friends on the Other Side, which is probably one of the most defining cards in purple, versus Second Star to the Right, which is an extraordinarily expensive card. It draws over double the amount of cards, 2.5 times the amount of cards as Friends on the Other Side. It also costs over 3 times more. It can be sung, but there's just so little going on over here. It's not inkable. It just doesn't check enough boxes to see play. And it only saw fringe play in certain Jafar-style decks, where Friends on the Other Side, if you're playing Amethyst, probably one of the reasons you are is because of Friends on the Other Side. So that's kind of the difference there. Another good indicator of if a card can be playable and core constructed is it an effect that's stapled onto a character card? What I mean by that is it an effect that takes an entire card, or is it part of the card? I'm going to, again, go to an example that I made a little bit earlier with one of the cards, and that was the 2-drop Pinocchio that exerts a character when he comes into play. Compare that to first chapter action Freeze. Pinocchio is not inkable. Freeze is. They both exert a character. Freeze keeps it exerted. Pinocchio does not. But Pinocchio is a 1-1-1, so he can quest for one. He has 1 strength and 1 willpower. Pinocchio saw infinitely more play than Freeze.
Yeah, you can pick him up and do it again.
Repeatable effects, right? We talked about Madam Mim already. There's a whole plethora of cards, and we're getting a new one, a new Madam Mim in the upcoming Shimmering Skies. Picking things up and putting them back down is going to be a color identity thing for purple. Like, that's what Amethyst wants to do, is pick things up and put them back down.
Mm-hmm.
That is extremely powerful with comes into play style effects, wherein one-time use actions, you're using an entire card. Pinocchio, I'm using part of a card. Now imagine Freeze said, gain 3 lore. All of a sudden, that's a lot more powerful of a card. Pinocchio can kind of do that. Pinocchio can trade with something. Pinocchio can get buffed and smack into something. Pinocchio can quest for the win. Freeze can't do any of that. It's always 1-for-1 in a card. Pinocchio can be 1/2-for-1, and that's a huge difference. When we're talking about costs of cards, the biggest increase in a game is from 0 to 1. Nothing to something. Something that costs 1 is way worse than something that costs nothing. The next biggest jump is 2, from 1 to 2, right? Because 2 is twice as much as 1. 2 to 3, that's not twice as much.
Right.
0 to 1 is infinitely more. 1 to 2 is twice as much. They're the two biggest costs in a game. So when you're evaluating cards, a card that costs 3 or 4 and a card that costs 1 or 0 or 2, there's a lot different evaluations going on. So cost, the ability to be stapled onto a card and do something essentially as part of a card, is huge. Multi-purpose is another thing that makes a card very playable in core constructed. A card that we're hemming and hawing about on our set review for Into the Inklands was Rise of the Titans. How important are locations going to be? We didn't think Lucky Dime was going to be as impactful as it ended up being, and ended up, because of the combination of things like McDuck Manor, Queen's Castle, and Lucky Dime, Rise of the Titans was insanely playable. It had technically 3 modes because it was inkable on top of destroying a location or an item. Banish things or ink it. Perfect. You don't play items or locations, we're inking it.
Yeah.
I play the 3rd mode.
Same with like Baboom, with it being able to target a location as well as a character.
Absolutely. Or being.
Yeah.
3 modes. We love it. That makes it very, very playable. What makes a card hard to evaluate is how I want to close this out, because I think it is worth calling out for sure. Is it a brand new card? Is it something we've never seen before? This happened to us in Into the Inklands when locations were introduced. We had no idea if they were going to be playable. How important was it that they were inkable? How important was the actual willpower of a location? How important was the cost to move to a location? How important was how much lore it generates? All questions that we're still asking to some extent today. We're starting to learn things. We know like some baselines now. If it has 7 willpower, it means it can't be one-shotted by Maui. So that's right. Very important. We've seen cards like Hercules start to come to the forefront to answer cards like this. That's another card that's just stats. Never in a million years would I have thought that a bad-looking Maui that was uninkable and only had 3 willpower ever be played. But it was being played like a bad Rise of the Titans in the Ruby Sapphire decks towards right. The end of set champs, because it's like, I just need something that can one-shot a Queen's Castle. I need something that can be Vitalisphered and smack into and answer a McDuck Manor. I need something like that, which is really, really surprising. And that's what makes these cards hard to evaluate. There's brand new cards. There's maybe a new effect that we've never seen before. This set has a legendary card. It's Sapphire Merlin that actually lets you search through your deck for any card you want.
Yeah.
We have never seen that in Lorcana. That's brand new. Searching your deck is not something that's commonly done in Lorcana, period. That is uncharted territory for us. So maybe it's going to be really good. Maybe it's too slow and clunky. Maybe we have to wait for the cheaper version of the legendary Merlin to come out.
Right.
And then, of course, there is the powerful but expensive aspect to a card. We saw this with Jafar. It was very expensive to play, but the ability could win you the game. So there's other things like that. And in tandem with Jafar, is it reliant on other cards to be good? Because that can also be a trap. Jafar, we've seen, I think, missed the mark. A lot of people put it at. A lot of people put it as completely game-changing and defining, like Madame Mim and Madame Medusa were. That card ended up being a little bit of a misfire. I think it is still a build-around card that's okay, but it's a build-around card that's okay. It's not a card that's so broken it was the first card to receive errata for the game.
Right.
So that's the difference. Cards that reward you for doing the thing you already want to do, on the other hand, are very dangerous, which is why we see errata for Bucky. That's a card that just goes, oh, are you already playing cards in the game? Oh, cool. Then have your opponent discard a card every time you play cards in the game. That's insane.
Yeah.
Oh, are you trying to win with lore? Are you going to play characters to quest? Cool. When you put this one into play, it's going to gain you a lore. You know what? As an added kicker, for no additional cost to you, when it leaves play, you gain a lore too. That's why it's the GOAT.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to evaluate cards for a plethora of reasons. So hopefully these little check boxes will help you with your evaluation. Hopefully it'll stop you from shouting yourself hoarse at us when we do our evaluation, which, by the way, at time of recording will be this Sunday, August 4th at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/supraliminalfilms. And, of course, we'll put it on here for all of you to consume if you prefer your podcasts mono-aural and no video. But it'll be in stereo, not mono-aural, which is the old mono versus stereo track. It was a joke if you're an audiophile. Hope you enjoyed that joke. Hope you enjoyed us giving you some insight. And we hope, beyond hope, when you're playing Lorcana, you
keep questing.